This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Last week's election in Britain was a shocker. The Labour Party, led by radical Jeremy Corbyn, received far more support than people thought it would. What does this tell us about British voters? We're going to talk to Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the data coming in from the election and what it says about the state of Britain today. Second, we'll talk about one of the most important geopolitical trends in the world, and that's the coming together of the two great Asian nations of Russia and China. This is something Herbert W. Armstrong said would happen as long as 80 years ago, but for the longest time, many analysts said, no way, it'll never happen. Boy, were they wrong, and was Mr. Armstrong right? Their cooperation, China's and Russia's, is growing all the time, and last week they announced it's going to increase even further. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this extraordinary and prophetically very significant development. Then we're going to talk about Iran. Iran has been making a push through Iraq and expanding its presence in Syria. Now it's becoming clear that it's about to achieve a virtual direct corridor all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. Our Middle East analyst Brent Nachtigall is in town here in Edmond, Oklahoma, all the way from Jerusalem. He's going to talk to us about this important development and how it's putting the challenge to America and any other nation concerned about Iran gaining too much power. And I'll finish off the program today by giving you a key ingredient in how to become a doer of the word. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Last week, British voters went to the polls, and 40% of them chose a party headed by an openly radical Marxist who's good friends with Islamist terrorist groups. This man didn't win a majority in Parliament, but he got a whole lot more support than anyone really expected him to, and now he's viewed as a legitimate representative of a huge segment of the British people. This is where democracy in Britain has taken us. Something has really gone disastrously wrong in Britain. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Richard Palmer from our office in Britain. We talked about this subject some on the Week in Review last week. We're going to dig in deeper into what this tells us about modern Britain. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So just a recap, we talked about this last week, but how radical is Jeremy Corbyn?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, he's basically an out-and-out communist and has completely imbued that whole philosophy's anti-Western, even anti-British kind of way of thinking. So, you know, he's basically in favor of every British enemy that there's been in recent times. He supported the terrorists in the IRA back during the Troubles against Britain. John MacDonald, one of his right-hand men, openly celebrated the death of British policemen. And at that time, Diane Abbott was talking about how every defeat of the British state is a victory for their movement. Diane Abbott also said that Britain invented racism. Jeremy Corbyn, then also again with that anti-Western attitude, he's been called Hamas and Hezbollah his friend. He's attended memorial ceremonies for PLO terrorists. And his whole cabal of colleagues has all been in favor of just a massive shift to a socialist state. John MacDonald has said, I am a Marxist. They don't really hide any of this all that well. He said, I want to smash the system. So it's a radical left, anti-Western philosophy that has just taken hold of the Labour Party and people thought would do incredibly badly in the election.
Right. Well, that's the extraordinary thing, isn't it? That Theresa May called this election because she thought it was a slam dunk. There's no way that these people would garner any kind of support of any real measure among the British populace, that it would award her a much greater power base in order to negotiate Brexit and so on. But she was so wrong. There were a lot of people who even they said that as radical as Labour was, that they didn't even do a very good job of campaigning, that there were mistakes that they made, that they expected, well, this would sink their chances even more. Of course, Theresa May didn't campaign very well, and she made some mistakes that seem to have hurt her as well. But this really was just a shocking result to a lot of people, and it is very revealing in the same kind of a way it seems that Brexit was of where we are in Britain today.
Absolutely. I mean, it was shocking even to members of the Labour Party. I think, you know, the vast majority of members of the Labour Party went into this, or MPs, members of Parliament of the Labour Party, thinking, well, we've got to distance ourselves from Jeremy Corbyn. Mm-hmm. We don't want him coming into my constituency. I'm going to talk against him because they thought he was a vote killer. And it turns out not to have been.
So it is interesting now they're having to recalibrate and recalculate and figure what does this mean for how we reach out to voters now. Even though Labour didn't get a majority, they definitely sent a strong message. And there are a lot of people who are trying to figure how does this affect the way that I operate now. So what are we seeing from the Labour politicians, and even more broadly in British politics as a result of this?
Well, you are starting to see more and more Labour politicians come around to Jeremy Corbyn's side to say we need to support him. Owen Smith, he was a Labour leader who campaigned against Jeremy Corbyn. He tried to unseat him as leader. He led the most recent effort to get rid of him. Because he's still very left wing, but he just led this effort to say, well, we need to get rid of this guy if we're going to win any votes. He lost that that leadership challenge, and now after the election, he's saying, well, I'm completely wrong. We need to get behind him, and you're seeing now the Labour Party just embrace these radically left policies of Jeremy Corbyn, ones that they were, to their credit, shunning beforehand.
I want to just read a quote from Brett Stevens' column from June 9th, just a few days ago. It was called The Year of Voting Recklessly. He was talking about the Corbyn victory. He said, it took three generations to lose the lessons of pre-war isolationism. It took two to ignore the benefits of post-war European integration. If Corbyn's rise is something to go by, it has taken just a single generation to forget the sins of the far left, anti-Semitism masquerading as anti-Zionism, anti-Americanism masquerading as pacifism, fellow traveling with dictators and terrorists masquerading as sympathy for the wretched of the earth. And he says, all this is on the voters. It's easy to come up with reasons for why populists, bigots, radicals, xenophobes, and useful idiots are now in or edging closer to power throughout the West. But democracy is a system in which people are only accountable to themselves. The recklessness of their leaders is a result of personal choices at the ballot box, not impersonal social or economic forces. It seems like he's really on to something here. You're talking about we get the leaders that we deserve, basically. And it's the mm-hmm. British people who have basically said we're comfortable sidling up to some of the radicalism that Jeremy Corbyn and his party represent. What do we know from the polling data, who these people are, and what does this tell us about the British voters?
Right. I think that's a good point. I think it's a lot of people, well, I think there's probably quite a lot of voters out there who are saying, I don't completely agree with everything Jeremy Corbyn does. I'm a little uncomfortable with the way he's been so friendly with some of these terrorists, but I personally would benefit in this, this, and this way from a Jeremy Corbyn victory. I like this promise. Therefore, I'm going to vote for him. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the polling data, I mean, one of the big themes that's been out there in all of the reports has been this youth swing behind Jeremy Corbyn. And I've got in front of me right now, we'll put this in the article I'm working on, I think it's just a stunning graph. And it shows how different age groups voted over the years. And then you look at it through, it starts even back in the 80s, you look at it kind of through the late 80s, the 90s, all the way up to 2010, and it's pretty constant. Those 44 and under are slightly more likely to vote left-wing, slightly more likely to vote Labour, about 10% more than average likely to vote Labour. And those 45 and over are slightly more likely, or sorry, 55 and over are slightly more likely than average to vote Conservative, again, about 10%. then starting in 2015 and then accelerating dramatically in this election, it just splits. Those 55 and over go one way quite firmly in the conservative, but then the younger voters go dramatically to the left, especially those aged 18 to 24. At this point, they've gone from, say, in the 2010 election being under 10% more likely to vote left to being around 50% more likely to vote left wing than average. Another bit of polling data from Lord Ashcroft's polling company found that 18% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted conservative compared to 67% who voted Labour. So
that's quite monolithic. It's as much as you would expect from just about any demographic that the age almost equates with the ideology.
Right. And it's gone, you know, 5 years ago, this was a slight thing. The young were slightly more likely to vote Labour. But now it's just absolutely overwhelming. And in combination with this, you also saw an increase in voter turnout. I think everyone's still waiting for the turnout data from Ipsos Mori that should provide a bit more granulated detail on this. But Sky News published some of their voter turnout and found that 18 to 24-year-olds had around a turnout of 66%, which is about average overall, but for that particular age group is phenomenal. Normally, the 18 to 24-year-old age group, the demographic or the voter turnout is usually around 40%. So he's generated this massive surge of enthusiasm among that age group that just hasn't been there in any other election.
And that's the way this is being interpreted, that it was Jeremy Corbyn's persona, it was him personally that stirred up the young to get out and vote?
Well, whether it's his persona or whether it's his policies, I think is up for debate.
So he was talking about making university free, for example. This is obviously
right.
Something that would be a big sell among that age demographic.
Exactly. So 10 years ago in Britain, university education basically was free. It was £1,000 a year if you were in a rich household, and if you were in a poorer household, it was free. Now it's a bit more than £9,000 a year. So you do have young people who their older siblings went to university for free and they're tens of thousands of pounds in debt. So it is something that has, you know, that's when he came along and said, well, I'll reverse that, I'll make it free. That generated a huge amount of enthusiasm. I mean, he really just touched all the things that most directly affect young voters. I think the other thing is housing and house prices. He promised to introduce rent controls to keep skyrocketing rent costs down. So he kind of promised an instant solution to some of the biggest problems facing young people. So I certainly think there was definitely a sense of enthusiasm for him personally, mm-hmm. for his personality, for just that kind of left-wing politics. But then I also think it was these kind of very tangible, you know, you vote for me, get me in office, and you are going to be $70,000-$80,000 better off. That kind of just direct response to an incentive as well.
And it's worth noting in that context that Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party had absolutely no possible way of paying for all of the promises that they made, that this was only going to take Britain into far deeper debt than it already is. But it is interesting, mm-hmm. pointing to the youth demographic in Britain that gave Labour the victory that it did. And we're using the word victory in somewhat relative terms here. But you see the same type of thing in America in a sense that it was the youth who have been stirred up to vote in the last three elections. Really, they were a big part of the reason for the Barack Obama's two victories and then Bernie Sanders' popularity in the Democratic Party primaries, that he actually was vaulted to near the top, second place in the Democratic Party, despite having views that a lot of people would have considered far outside the mainstream. The difference in Britain here is that not only are Jeremy Corbyn's views far more radical, but that he actually gained enough support to have the position that he has. And his victory in this election is only going to further cement his place within the Labour Party.
Right. And just before we move on from that education point, I think another poll that I think is absolutely fascinating found that that only 7% of university staff supported the Conservatives and 50% said they supported Labour. And then, you know, the others, they supported the Liberal Democrats and the Greens, with 5% supporting the Greens, which that's phenomenal. That's you know, you're almost as likely to find a university professor that supports the Green Party, this party that has one member of member in Parliament. It's this, you know, fairly tiny minority party, as you are someone who supports the Conservatives, the party that's governed the country for the last 7 years. So that's a phenomenal bias. And actually, then you look at that and you find that the university staff are more left wing than 18 to 24 year old voters are. Maybe if anything, they deserve a bit of credit those 11% or so, or those 18% that voted Conservative for resisting this overwhelmingly left-wing teaching that's been coming at them really for all their lives, but certainly in university education. And then, of course, the European Union and Britain's role in the European Union played a major role in this election. And that's something where, you know, the EU has done a lot to get pro-EU propaganda across in schools. And I think we're starting to see some of that, some of that pay off.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you're right. Just as in the U.S., there is this massive role that young people are playing in pushing politics in this direction. But going off what you said about, you know, the similarity of the trends that we've seen here, that's a point that's really stood out to me in working on this. You know, I've got an article we've been working on for the next Trumpet magazine on this subject, one for the website. I've been going back over Mr. Gerald Flurry's book, Great Again, where he talks about this trend in the United States. And it's really stood out to me how similar the trend is in the UK in so many specific ways. Even, you know, he brings out the points about education in that book and about how educators and our how it's a reflection on the failings of our education system. And you can say exactly the same thing about this big swing to Jeremy Corbyn. But then so many of the other specifics. He has a whole chapter in that booklet about the attack on the police. Mm-hmm. And you see the same thing among Jeremy Corbyn and his supporters. You know, John McDonnell especially has been, you know, he's said some terrible things about the police, especially back when you had the police putting down riots coming from communist parties and left-wing parties back in the 70s and 80s. And he was, you know, celebrating the death of police officers or calling for police to be attacked. Diane Abbott saying that the Home Office, that's the department of the government that runs the policing, is institutionally racist. Exactly the same kind of statements that you see from those leaders in the United States. It's the same in terms of their support of communism and Marxism. And Mr. Flurry in that book talks about how Marxists want to smash the system. And he almost uses identical language to what John McDonald uses when he talks about, in kind of these more private meetings of radical leftists, what he wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in so many ways exactly it's the same trend played out with different people, with some regional differences, of course. But it's the same trend and the same spirit behind it as what we saw with the rise of the radical left in the United States.
Fascinating stuff. I think to go back and reread Great Again in light of what's happening in Britain really is a good move to make. And it is that, like, as you said, it's the same spirit behind bringing both of these countries down this road to destruction. And so if you understand what's happening in the United States, you understand what's happening in Britain. We appreciate that very much. Fascinating stuff, Richard. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He has an article that's about to be published on thetrumpet.com on this subject, just what is behind the latest election result in Britain, what it tells us about British voters. You can go to thetrumpet.com and find that article there. Richard, we really appreciate you bringing that to us.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
One of the most important geopolitical trends in the world today is the alliance developing between Asian giants Russia and China. This is something that the Trumpet has been watching for decades because it is explicitly prophesied in the Bible. But for the longest time, it seemed like this was an impossibility. Now, though, in the last 5 years especially, it's been happening right before our eyes. We see this alliance developing more month by month. Most recently, these two nations have been making tremendous strides in boosting their military cooperation. To talk about this, we have Trumpet's Asia analyst, Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So we'll start by talking about this most recent roadmap for military cooperation that these two nations just announced.
Sure. Yeah, this was an announcement that came on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, which was held on June 8th and 9th in Astana, Kazakhstan. And just on the sidelines of that, the defense ministers of Russia and China gave a brief interview to Interfax and said basically that they're planning to pretty soon publish a roadmap of that maps out this apparently pretty significant increase in their military cooperation and military events starting this year and going all the way to 2020. So there's a quote from the Chinese defense minister, Cheng Wenkan. He said, "This year, we plan to hold very large, enormous, important events." And then his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, said, "Our experts have prepared a roadmap for development in the military sphere between Russia and China in the years 2017 to 2020. And I think one pretty interesting aspect of this is just that they called attention to the personal role that both Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin have played in boosting Russo-Chinese military cooperation, and even apparently specifically with this new roadmap that they're unrolling. Here's one quote from Mr. Cheng. He says, "In recent years, under the personal guidance of our heads of state, the level of cooperation and trust between the armed forces of China and Russia have continuously increased. The scope of our cooperation is constantly expanding, and the trend of developing military cooperation has maintained a very good trajectory." So it really sounds like the presidents of the countries there, Mr. Xi and Mr. Putin, have a personal interest in this, and they're playing a personal role in just continuing to boost what is already astoundingly close military cooperation up to uncharted territory, brand new levels.
Right. It seems like in some ways this kind of takes you aback a little bit that what's already been a very strong alliance that they're talking about, I mean, they're using some pretty dramatic adjectives, enormous and important right. moves to add on to what they've already been doing in recent years.
Yeah, that's right. And I also thought this was a fairly brief interview that they gave to Interfax, but there was one other statement that I thought was pretty interesting that sort of shows the way they want to sell this to the world. As they see the U.S., no longer as the defender of global values, becoming really unreliable in the eyes of a lot of our allies and other countries. And I think they're trying to sell this as these two countries want to become the new kind of defenders of the planet. Here's the quote from Mr. Shoigu. He says, "It is important that Russia and China are ready to defend the world with mutual efforts and to strengthen international security." So if you're aware of the realities of this situation and the ideologies that are really motivating the leadership in both Russia and China, you know that it's probably not actually something that's good news for the world and that's defending the planet. But mm-hmm. but that sort of seems to be how they're trying to package it.
Very dramatic announcement there. I'd like to just back up and go talk about some of the reasons why analysts have really thought that this type of cooperation would never happen. You know, I think analysts have long understood that if Russia and China ever did come together in a significant way, that would really impact geopolitics. It would have very wide-reaching ramifications, but it was thought impossible. Why would that be?
Well, it actually goes back to the communist era in the 1950s. both the Soviet Union, led by Russia, of course, and China were both communist nations. And for a while, there were efforts to cooperate in a way. But then after Joseph Stalin died in 1953, there was a shift that pretty drastically set in, and they became fierce competitors with each other, sort of competing to see which one would become the one true communism, the way they saw it, and which one would become the leader of the smaller nations of the world that were trying to transform to communist governments and ideologies. And so that competition between the two of them got pretty bloody. It actually erupted into border wars several times in the 1960s, and it remained fierce throughout pretty much until the collapse of the Soviet Union. So for decades and decades, these two were just sort of at each other's throats. And then even more recently, when there has been strides toward cooperation, you know, long after the USSR collapsed and the Russian Federation has tried to cooperate with China, even then, the analysis from Western think tanks has been that this is superficial. The Westerners have said, you know, this looks like they're forming some sort of a partnership, but it's very superficial, it's very shaky, and it's not anything that's going to really impact global geopolitical affairs. And that's just because of this lingering competition that I believe was sort of left over from that Cold War era. There was the feeling that Russia could only be a leader, and that China was more powerful in terms of its conventional military. And so analysts would say, how could that possibly be? Russia would never sign up to be an ally with this nation that really, you know, when the rubber hits the road, could militarily probably conquer Russia. That was a big part of it. And then just over Russian concerns that China could essentially colonize Russia's Far East. You know, it's very sparsely populated, Russia's Far East there. Then China's just to the south of the border and has a huge population that's basically trying to find, in some areas, trying to find space. So there's a lot of fear. At least Western analysts say there's a lot of Russian fear that China's poised to possibly take over those parts that, that Russia would have a hard time defending. So for just for a lot of strategic reasons like that, Western analysts have been skeptical. They've said it's shaky.
So something has definitely changed in the calculus of these nations that's driving them together. What are some of the trends happening in the world today that are causing them to overcome some of those what would be perceived as inherent conflicts between them?
Well, in a way, it's tough to pinpoint exactly when this became, you know, a partnership that's sort of beyond the point of no return, too big to fail, those kinds of things. But if you look at 2012, that was a landmark year for boosted military cooperation. Personally, I feel like 2014 was a massive year for this, a game-changing year because of what we saw with Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula. At that time, that move was labeled as illegal by most of the world. The U.S. and European powers really ostracized Russia, slapped all kinds of sanctions on it. But what happened in the East? China said, that's fine. And hey, Russia, if you feel like you're being given the cold shoulder by the West, we're ready to partner up with you. So that was a huge year for it. And then 2015, the very next year, they held joint naval drills in the Mediterranean Ocean, right there in NATO's backyard. I mean, that's considered NATO territory. And they held these massive drills, totally unprecedented. The very next year after that, 2016, we saw joint drills in the South China Sea. It's like it was China's turn that year. And that came just after an international court at The Hague had said China's claims to the South China Sea are not valid. But Russia sort of, by joining China for those military drills in the South China Sea, showed that it viewed that Hague ruling as totally invalid. So really, three huge years in a row, 2014, 2015, 2016, were just steadily boosting this partnership to new levels every year.
What is your view of, say, just the factors that are driving them into each other's arms?
Well, a lot of it, I think, is just kind of a polarization maybe in the world that we see. Europe is, there just seems to be a deepening divide between East and West, and it's to the exclusion of the United States. The U.S. seems to be increasingly isolationist in some ways under President Trump. It's very much this new America First type thing. But then in Europe, there are more and more moves for Europe to be unified in a way, to combat mass migration of Middle Easterners and North Africans into Europe. So there are all kinds of moves that we talk about for increased European militarization and unification. So Russia watches that with a wary eye. China, I think, also is a little bit nervous about it in some ways. And so I think the cooperation between Russia and China is in some ways a preemptive, just a plan to be able to combat what they see possibly emerging as a unified European bloc.
Yeah.
So they want to be ready to have their own bloc if such a bloc does emerge in Europe, which we see happening.
So you study this and you get into the weeds and into the details, and it must be really quite extraordinary to witness this taking place to the degree that you do in just studying this and analyzing the region. But the fact is that this is something that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about decades ago, even when they were at each other's throats, as you put it. And that a lot of people looking at it would have said that this is, you know, the idea that there's going to be strong Russian-Chinese cooperation is just, you know, it's not rooted in reality. So in your view, this is something that the Trumpet has talked about for decades. Herbert W. Armstrong talked about, you know, for decades before us. We have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, specifically drawing attention to these two nations coming together and being the anchor of an even broader Asian alliance. In your view, from your perspective on the sidelines, just how extraordinary is it to see this happening just the way Mr. Armstrong said that it would?
I think it's really extraordinary, and it vindicates so much of what he wrote at a time when this looked like basically a geopolitical impossibility. Mm-hmm. In 1934, the June-July issue of The Plain Truth said, quote, "Scripture prophesies two great military powers to arise in the last days. One, the revival of the Roman Empire by a federation of 10 nations in the territory of the ancient Roman Empire, and the other, Russia with her allies, possibly China or Japan." 1934. Hmm. You know, at this time, China was a bunch of peasants mm-hmm. farming out in the rice paddies. They didn't look like anything that would be militarily relevant. And then in 1959, The Plain Truth said, and this was at a time when those border disputes were really hot between Russia and China. So anyone in the world would have looked at that and said, wow, are Russia and China going to go to war? Well, Mr. Armstrong was saying exactly the opposite. In 1959, The Plain Truth, the December issue said, quote, "China's constant dream for centuries has been ultimate world conquest. China knows, however, that in this highly industrialized age, she can accomplish this dream only as an ally of Russia. China is now ready to begin devouring the rest of Asia with Russia's secret military backing." So pretty extraordinary, just if you consider what was happening at that time. You know, 1959, these two powers were vying for which would emerge as the leader of the one true communism. But Mr. Armstrong could see, despite that bickering, despite those conflicts, eventually, because of what is written in the Bible, they would come together.
Amazing stuff. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Russia and China cooperation, and specifically, most recently, military cooperation that is they're announcing is going to be ramped up in the few years ahead of us. He's working on an article on this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The most powerful nation in the Middle East is Iran. In fact, we have pointed to a prophecy in the book of Daniel dubbing this nation as king of the region. It's been seeking this dominance since the Iranian Revolution in 1979, but only in recent years has it really begun to cement its gains in the Middle East. And with recent moves, Iran has nearly locked in what some are referring to as a Shia Crescent, a swath of territory in the region controlled by the Shia Muslim nation of Iran. We have an article on thetrumpet.com by Callum Wood called Iranian Militias Reach Syrian Border. To talk about this, we have in the studio here in Edmond, Oklahoma, our Middle East analyst, Brent Noctegal. Good to have you here.
Yeah, it's good to be here in the studio with you instead of a Skype. Yep, in the flesh.
You're much more handsome in three dimensions than you are on the on the computer screen. So tell us what Iran is up to here.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's a maneuver that we've seen both on the Iraqi side of the Syrian border and the Syrian side of the Syrian-Iraqi border. This territory in eastern Syria is barren. It's kind of a bit of a wasteland, extremely unimportant for any type of material resources. But it is just growing in strategic importance because Iran, as we've seen over the past 2 years, as they've fought the Islamic State through the use of their Shiite militias, the largest one of those, our largest conglomeration of those militias being the PMU, the Popular Mobilization Units, they've been working in Iraq. And there's over 100,000 fighters. They've been pushing out the Islamic State from southern Iraq all the way up till this battle with Mosul right now in the north. We've talked about that before. And what we've seen is Iran, through that group, gobble up territory that the Islamic State was vacated because of losing battles against them. And they're pushing really close up to the Iraqi side of the Syrian-Iraqi border. And in fact, we talked about it on the show, I think maybe a month ago, how Iran had this desire to ensure that they controlled this border territory and that they wanted to create this roadway from Tehran all the way across to the Mediterranean Sea, and that they had an idea to do that, and that that would probably go along a northern Syrian route, and how the United States kind of stepped in and became more robust in their presence through some of their own fighting forces on the ground. And that made Iran change their calculus, realize that if they want this roadway, they're going to have to push further south in Iraq to do this. And that's what we've seen over the past month, is the eastern side, or the Iraqi territory of, south of Mosul, really coming under fire from Shiite militias belonging to Iran to oust the Islamic State. And now what we're seeing over the last 2 weeks is the same thing taking place on the Syrian side of the border as they push eastward so that they could meet together at some point somewhere along the border between Syria and Iraq, so that Iran can have this thoroughfare, this Shia crescent, as you mentioned, that connects them all the way across through Iraq, southern Syria to Lebanon and the Syrian coast on the Mediterranean.
So with Iran's forces already in Syria and Iran already having a presence there and now taking more and more control over territory within Iraq, which is really extraordinary in and of itself, and we probably need to talk about that specifically as well. Essentially, what we have here is a linkage of the forces on both sides of this Iraqi-Syria border.
Right, and that's the worry. That's the worry, especially for Israel, because if you look at the end of that roadway, you've got, you know, the state of Israel that will be virtually surrounded by Iranian proxies, which they have been, but now they're going to have access to Iranian arms that could just drive down the road, basically, across these make-believe borders that don't, the states might exist, but Iran controls the powers on both sides of them.
Right, a much different scenario when you have Iraq really as the number one enemy of Iran in the region, serving as somewhat of a buffer, and you've got Iraqi forces aimed eastward at Iran, and Iran distracted by what's going on there, then just point by point, as the United States has entered into the equation, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, eliminating its number one enemy in the region, Iran, as we predicted would happen as far back as 2003 and even before that, Iran is just making these gains more and more to the point where really there's nothing in the way.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing in the way. That's what's interesting. As I was just researching for this and even reading Callum's article, nobody's discussing whether Iran can reach the Syrian border. They've already done it.
It's taken for granted.
It's in the bag. It's taken for granted. And even though the Americans, the U.S. has just poured so many resources into stopping this from happening after they removed Saddam Hussein, it looks like it's going to happen just because of the resolve and the longevity of Iran's policy. I mean, they are there to stay. They have their long-term plans, their strategic interests. American presidents come and go. The American population loses the stomach for war, understandably in many cases. But the Iranians have a firm resolve, and they have captured this territory in eastern Iraq.
It just underlines what Stephen Fleury has been talking about with how much the Americans are responsible for the rise of Iran. He's talking about the King of the South and the European power termed King of the North in prophecy, but just how much the United States, not just the Obama administration, but the Bush administration before him, and even before him. I mean, you can go back to the Gulf War in 1991, in a sense, with the United States targeting Iraq. At that time, Iran wasn't nearly as strong of a terrorist power, but it certainly had its aims were clear from the very beginning of the Iranian Revolution. But America really bears a lot of the blame here.
They do. They do for sure. And it's just interesting looking at the situation that exists right now with Mr. Trump in power. I believe that he is aware of the danger of this moment. As far as, or at least people in his government, the military underneath him, they are aware of what's going on with these moves from Iran. It's one thing to gobble up Iraq, and it's one thing to fund Hezbollah and send missiles over, but it's another to virtually control the land bridge all the way across. And we are there's a couple of things that could happen in this situation, just because we know that this is Iran's goal. The United States knows its goal. Turkey knows that's the goal of Iran. All the Kurds in the north know that Iran wants to do this. And we are heading to a point where either the United States is going to have to back down and back out of eastern Syria, or they're going to have to confront Iran in this. And what we've seen in the Syrian civil war for the past 5 or 6 years, the United States targeting the Islamic State along with their international coalition, that's good and well. Mr. Trump comes in. He does target the Syrian regime, ally of Iran, on the airstrike with those airstrikes, or the Tomahawk cruise missiles that came across and hit the airstrip. Since that time, we've had three other direct attacks by the United States against Iranian proxies in the past month, and it is heating up. There is a United States base on the border between Syria and Iraq. We have had Iranian proxies approached that base in 3 separate occasions over the past month. In 3 separate occasions, they were destroyed after warnings. And right now, the United States is in secret negotiations with the Russians. Mr. Tillerson met with him with a Russian representative in Jordan 2 weeks ago to try and discuss this very situation, what Iran is doing in southern and eastern Syria. So we're at a really critical point in the war against the Islamic State, Syrian civil war, and the decision comes down to, will the United States stop Iran from joining its forces in Syria and Iraq?
Yeah, you can see that the importance of this moment, the way that you're describing it, just how apparent, how obvious what Iran is trying to do has become. And you can look at the United States right now still is probably the most the party that's most invested in as far as having material on the ground in order to stop Iran. Knowing what we know from a prophetic standpoint, in a sense, you can see a lot of the enemies of Iran, those in the region. And we've talked a lot about even how Europe is really concerned about trying to encircle Iran and to prevent its spread within the Middle East. In a sense, it's kind of an important moment for them as well.
For sure. It's an important moment for everyone looking in. And this is why the United States, even though Mr. Trump doesn't want people to think he's colluding with the Russians, he is talking with the Russians to stop it. And the Russians are concerned. that they don't want Iran to gather too much power in even Syria and the Middle East. The Europeans have to be concerned. I mean, up till now, Iran has been kind of contained to Iran, Iraq, and proxies around the world. But now, as I said, they could the reality that Iran could hold territory all the way to the Mediterranean Sea from Afghanistan over, that's got to make some people in Europe, we expect it would, make them think, well, maybe we need to step up our contribution to make sure those forces don't join. This is might be the reason why Germany was so quick to say, yeah, well, let's choose Jordan for our base to now start flying in our missions against the Islamic State. Where that base is in Jordan that they're going to be flying from is very close to this area of looming battle between Iranian forces, American forces, American-supported people. So maybe they are in a position to stop this from happening as well.
If it weren't clear enough what Iran was intending to do, we had a very prominent Iranian visitor to this very territory that we're talking about, this border area. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, over the past couple of days, one of the Iranian state media agencies, Tasmin, I believe it is, they have run pictures of Qassem Soleimani, their Quds Force leader, the man that's in charge of any type of action from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps outside of Iran. He shows up at the border, takes a lot of pictures with a Afghani militia on the Syrian side of the border. So this, again, as you say, wherever he goes, you know that Iran's, that is the most prominent well, the most important feature of Iran's current strategy is where he shows up. And you can expect that he's overseeing this strategy right now to ensure this border territory belongs to Iran. He was on the Syrian side, coming across with Afghani troops that are Shiites that are created, I think, back in 2013, this division. And
Iran isn't shy about sending a message, is it?
No, not at all. And it's very obvious. And to the world, it shows this is what we're planning on doing. Are you going to stop us? And if you want to stop us, I have 100,000 troops on this side of the border in Iraq. And I forget, I think it's about 40 or 50,000 troops. These aren't including the actual militaries of Iraq or even the Syrian regime, their troops, or even the Russian forces. These are proxy forces that answer directly to Iran. We're talking about, you know, 140,000 troops either side of the border. Do you want to stop that? You can if you want, but it's going to, we're going to fight for it, and we have the resolve to put this strategy into action. So, I mean, I would say right now I've been saying this for years, but we are at the most interesting potential turning point in the Middle East in reference to Islamic State, Syrian civil war right now, just because it's coming to a head and the troops of the United States and their people they're supporting and Iran and the people they're supporting are about to rub up against each other.
Yeah, extraordinary. And to think that, it just makes me think of that word that is used in Daniel's prophecy, that Iran pushes, you know, that this is a push. It does represent a push. It represents a move that demands a response, in a sense, knowing what we know about the fact that Syria and Iran are not going to remain aligned, that Syria is going to turn away, that you would expect that, well, how much longer could this go on before you did see some kind of a robust response from one of Iran's enemies? And
right. And now that it is at, you know, the world can see where we're at in this situation, it is a time for extreme vigilance to what's going on in the most boring part of the world outside of this moment, Eastern Syria. Bear in mind what the United States is doing with Russia. I wouldn't be surprised if it comes out with some type of deal there to reduce Iranian influence, at least in the short term. And then, of course, watch if Europe gets antsy for what Iran is doing as well.
Yep. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Iran's moves into Eastern Syria. He has an article online. We have an article actually published by trumpet writer Callum Wood, Iranian Militias Reach Syrian Border. Go check it out at thetrumpet.com. It's great to have you here, Brent. Thanks for coming in.
It was fun. Thank you.
In It's time for today's last word.
I am teaching my son piano lessons. When we have a lesson, I give him instructions on how to spend his time practicing that week. And I can get really specific. Play this scale at 4/16th notes to the click at 104 clicks per minute. Make sure you don't let your left index finger collapse. If you make a mistake, I want you to put a check on your paper. Then play that scale perfectly 2 times before you move on. And if you can't finish that scale in 2 minutes, put an X on the paper, move on to the next scale. At your next practice, focus on the scales you had trouble with, decrease the tempo until you can play them perfectly, then increase 1 metronome click at a time until it's at tempo. You get the idea. When my son sits down to practice, he decides what he's going to do. He can scrupulously follow my instructions, or he can do some approximation of what I said and hope it's good enough. When he takes the second course, then his growth as a piano player is hindered. And my ability to help him is limited because he's not carrying out my instructions. I revealed to him my will. This is the means by which I want to help him become a better pianist. It's on him to do, to carry out what I said to the detail. There's a key ingredient he needs if he's going to follow through with what I told him. What is that ingredient? James 1 and verse 22 says, "Be you doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves." How can we be doers of the word? Well, in some very real ways, it comes down to this key ingredient. It may be the most important ingredient. Now, of course, to be a doer of the word, you have to know exactly what you're being asked to do. And there are times when it's difficult to discern what God wants. Maybe you have a hard decision to make, and you have multiple equally good or equally bad options. But, you know, there are a lot of times and a lot of areas where we probably know exactly what God's will is. God communicates his will quite clearly in a lot of ways. It's on us to, number one, pay attention and listen intently, and then, number two, to do it cheerfully, to discipline ourselves to follow through with what we know we're supposed to do. Herbert Armstrong defined righteous character this way. This creation of right spiritual character in us demanded free moral agency, that man must intelligently choose the right as opposed to the wrong, that he exercise free choice, develop self-discipline. What is this righteous spiritual character, he asked? It is that controlled ability in a separate independent entity to come to a right knowledge of the true from the false, the right from the wrong, and by free choice to choose the right and the true, and further to use the self-discipline to will and to actually do the right. How can we be doers of the word? In the end, so much of it comes down to self-discipline. Now, we have to understand that human effort doesn't create the character of God. We can't just will ourselves into righteousness. But how can God create his character in us if we don't do what he tells us? When you study the Bible, or you read an article, or hear a sermon or lecture, or you do some self-examination, and you learn something you need to be doing, what determines whether you will be a doer of the word at that point? It comes down to how much you discipline yourself to do it. You have to study your notes. You have to convert that message into action steps and get specific and give yourself reminders and put it into your schedule and tell your buddy about it so he'll hold you accountable. And above all, when you don't feel like doing it, you do it anyway because you know you should. Mr. Armstrong wrote, "I have defined character, that is true, righteous, holy character, as one coming to the knowledge of the true as opposed to the false values, the right instead of the wrong way, and two, making of one's own free will and volition the choice to do the right instead of the wrong." And then he says, three, the exercise of the will in actually doing the right instead of the wrong. Character, then, once the true knowledge is acquired and the right decision made, involves self-discipline. The truly educated person is a self-disciplined person. Again, this may be the most important key to being a doer of the word. Mr. Armstrong continued, what then does this self-discipline involve? Two things. One, self-restraint, to resist the lower impulses and pulls in human nature, to restrain the self from desires, impulses, habits, or customs which are contrary to the right way. And two, self-propulsion, or determined initiative, to drive the self to do those things which ought to be done. Failing to do is a lack of self-discipline. Doing the easy thing instead of the right thing, it's a lack of self-discipline. Giving in to whims and distractions, that's a lack of self-discipline. In most cases, recognizing our failures as a deficit of self-discipline puts the blame right where it belongs. It's on us. God is doing all he can to help us, and it's he who builds holy, righteous character in us. He gets all the credit, but he can't do that if we don't have the self-discipline to do as he directs. God gets the credit for our successes. We get the blame for our failures. Now, carnally, we want to take the credit for our successes and pass blame off for our failures, but we're only going to have real growth in life when we get this right. We are to be doers of the word. God gives us his word. We have to be doers of it. He reveals his will. We must do it. Ask God to show you what to do and to give you the will to follow through, and then be tough on yourself. Discipline yourself. Be sure you're doing all you can to follow through and do as God instructs, so you truly can become a doer of the word. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Winston Churchill. Criticism may not be agreeable, but it is necessary. It fulfills the same function as pain in the human body. It calls attention to an unhealthy state of things. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.